later in Macro Sunday.
But you wrote an interesting piece about how China's industrial production is almost back to pre-COVID levels, among other things based on air pollution indicator. Enlighten us a little bit about that.
Well, as per usual, we cannot trust the official numbers from China. It's when you look at air pollution, it's pretty obvious that China went through a severe industrial recession in 2022-23. It never made the way to official numbers. I think you could even argue that they went through an overall recession without it showing up in the numbers. Point being here that when you look at air pollution over industrial centers such as...
You're listening to Macro Sunday, hosted by Mikkel Rosenvold. Hello out there and welcome to this week's Macro Sunday. My name is Mikkel Rosenvold and it's my great pleasure to host this week's show. This is not the familiar voice introducing Macro Sunday, but fear not, Andreas is with us. He has gone off to sunny Greece in the Mediterranean, small island down there in Mamma Mia land. Andreas, how are you?
Good. It's a bit of a struggle to travel with a newborn in 30 degrees Celsius, but other than that, I'm pretty upbeat.
Yeah. So hotter than the CPI report, perhaps? No, sorry, I couldn't resist that. We'll get back to that in a moment. On our agenda today, we have an interview with the great Marvin Barth of Thematic Markets. We're talking China, we're talking geopolitics in the long term. So very interesting interview there. We're going to touch upon the CPI report, of course. Talk even more about China, Andreas. And then we're going to finish off the show with a look at the current business cycle. And some actionable ideas from us there. So great show ahead. And yeah, let's get on with it. Andreas, let's get started with the CPI print this week. Surprised a little bit to the dovish side, which supported some of our long risk bets. What's your takeaway?
Well, admittedly, we had a hotter print penciled in than what we got. Let's just start there. And I think especially shelter costs surprised on the dovish side of expectations. We had a small reacceleration penciled in, and we obviously got the opposite. And I guess that's the reason why markets have seen this as a dovish CPI report. Powell and his lieutenants basically refer to this shelter cost category as the one that they put their money on in relation to a continued disinflation over the course of this year. And therefore, this was essentially the best possible news for them in relation to this category on a standalone basis. Setting shelter aside, I'm not necessarily of the view that this is a CPI report that screams rate cuts. The good old Powell indicator of core service inflation ex shelter is still super hot, much more hot than a CPI print that you can take comfort in as a central banker. So, I mean, yes, we had that one glimpse of hope in shelter. Let's see if it continues. I doubt it. But other than that, inflation is still too hot.
Yeah.
Short and sweet. Yeah.
So how do you think this, one thing is how it should be taken now. How do you think this will be taken down within the mind of Jay Powell?
I mean, if you look at the Fed speak over the week, it's been a mixed bag of goodies, but I've especially listened to Williams of the committee. He's obviously one of the founding fathers behind the R star estimate called Laubach-Williams, one of the models that they put a lot of emphasis on within the Fed system. He said earlier the week that he forecasts a CPI print in the low twos by year end. That is even on the soft side of market expectations if you look at the CPI fixings in market pricing. And he's typically one of the most vocal lieutenants of Powell. So I given that, seems like they're a bit more upbeat on the inflation outlook here. And on top of that, I think this basically fuels what I've labeled the FCI loop. Powell is very reluctant to open the door for a discussion on rate hikes. This will basically fuel that narrative that there's no chance whatsoever of higher interest rates from here, leaving the door open for markets to reflate even further. I think that will ultimately lead to higher interest rates, but that's basically the second-hand discussion or the second-round discussion of this. But for now, this will allow the markets to continue to rally, I think, given that it fuels the narrative that shelter inflation is coming down. It fuels the narrative that the Federal Reserve will be able to cut interest rates later this year. I ultimately don't think they will, but for now, that's basically the narrative of the market, and you shouldn't fight the tape here.
If you like more on our inflation coverage, especially our, I should call it nowcasting ability of inflation, which we take great pride in, check out stainresearch.com for all our coverage and our forecasts on that. You can check out our data hub as well, where you can use our forecasts to as an input in our structured asset allocation model as well. So a lot to do if you're interested in inflation. StenoResearch.com is absolutely the place to go. Andres, shifting geographically to the other side of the earth, to China. We're going to talk a lot more China and geopolitics with Marvin Barth. But you wrote an interesting piece about how China's industrial production is almost back to pre-COVID levels, among other things based on air pollution indicator. Enlighten us a little bit about that.
Well, as per usual, we cannot trust the official numbers from China. It's when you look at air pollution, it's pretty obvious that China went through a severe industrial recession in 2022-23. It never made the way to official numbers. I think you could even argue that they went through an overall recession without it showing up in the numbers. Point being here that when you look at air pollution over industrial centers such as Beijing, Shenzhen, and Shanghai, you get a non-manipulated view of the trends, right? Since you cannot manipulate air pollution, of course you can to a certain extent, but it's trickier at least. The point here is that the air pollution is back at levels seen pre the pandemic. And if we discount the trend in air pollution, which is obviously going down, given a shift towards greener energy policies on a trend basis, this is a pretty strong hint that industrial production is actually above pre-pandemic levels in China again. And we know, and you've also been covering that, Mikkel, how we know how they've basically treated manufacturing as their go-to weapon of choice here, given the malaise ongoing in real estate, given their struggles to reignite the consumer demand. And they've had success stories within EVs, within solar panels, within wind turbines, and so on and so forth. Adding to that, we're obviously seeing the first signs of the Chinese authorities now pulling out the big gun in their attempts to combat the malaise within the real estate sector. So overall, it's a bit tricky to be downbeat on China right now. You know, I've preferred to trade this via proxies, both the materials sector fund in the US, the copper trade, and so on and so forth. So we've made a lot of money indirectly betting on China, but we haven't made a lot of money directly betting on China, and maybe we should look at that.
Yeah. Let's just stay on copper for a little while. Some of our models are suggesting that the copper price has finally reached a level a bit too high. But there are obviously some idiosyncratic topic still going on pushing the price up. I mean, it's how do you see the future for the copper price over the next weeks and months?
Well, it's almost crystal clear when you look at the stock levels of China that they've been buying strategically. Mm. And it's always tricky to figure out exactly why. I mean, the vanilla explanation would be that they do it ahead of a devaluation of the CNY. We've been banging the drum on an imminent risk of a CNY devaluation for a few weeks so far without luck. The other reason could be that they've received some forewarnings from Blinken and Yellen when they visited Beijing over the course of 24 of these tariffs implemented by the Biden administration over the past week. If they got those forewarnings, I consider that likely now. I guess you could argue that this material strategic purchase of copper stocks, by the way, also iron ore and other critical resources, you could argue that it's an attempt to make an early preemptive power grab on the supply chain globally here. We've seen how the physical copper market has turned extremely tight as a consequence, also in the US. So they've basically made a maneuver here ahead of the tariffs implemented by the Biden administration, and probably a very clever maneuver. The question is whether they need the copper. but I'd like to get your take on that as well, Mikkel, because I had a few discussions with clients over the past week on this copper topic. In 23, the U.S. administration added copper to the list of medium-term critical materials. And to my knowledge, the U.S. does not have a strategic reserve of copper as they do with oil, but maybe they should have.
And
I guess that could be a new catalyst for the copper price in case they actually went down that road.
Yeah, and maybe they should have built that before the copper price soared 25%. You could argue, but that's of course just a monetary issue. No, absolutely. I think it's obvious that when you want to move all these industries and these strategic industries, build it and a strategic industrial supply chain, you need some of these resources, and you need to have them both to be able to, like the US have been doing with oil, to influence the world price of copper, to keep those supply chains profitable and alive, which is critical for the US as well, and obviously to have it for all your military needs as well, to be able to build all those weapons which are increasingly going to be needing copper. So absolutely, copper is a strategic resource, that there are going to be a larger number of those. I think the US, as we've been discussing, is decreasing its strategic storage of oil and petroleum, but perhaps shifting that need to other resources and commodities is realistic, I think. Absolutely. Yep. One thing you cannot put on stock, Andreas, is freight capacity. We've seen freight rates jump over the past weeks. Really no news coming out of the Red Sea situation. We had an Israeli ship getting taken out in the Strait of Hormuz, but like, what's going on here? Is this the trickle-down effects of what we've been seeing all year, or what's going on?
So the simple explanation here is that no news is bad news. Yeah. We wrote an article 6-7 weeks ago, basically just ahead of this reignition of freight rates, called No News is Bad News. If you look at shipping volumes, seasonally speaking, over the year, we're talking peak season into summer. And given that there is a constraint on capacity, we still see the vast majority of ships sailing south of Africa. We see prolonged queues. We see issues in terms of getting the capacity on time and so on and so forth in shipping space. This was something that was sort of meant to happen if we didn't get a truce in Gaza or whatever's needed to solve this situation in the Red Sea. So as long as nothing happens, freight rates will continue up into the summer. That's basically almost a given, if you ask me, due to seasonal pressures on shipping volumes and so on and so forth. And we can talk more about that in the outro section after the interview with Marvin Barth. But when we look at nowcasting of shipping volumes, the demand for goods in the US and so on and so forth, there are no signs of an imminent slowdown. Hence, if supply is constrained, the demand side will outpace it basically from here.
Great.
But Miguel, let me ask you in relation to this. You've basically promised us the truce in Gaza a couple of times. I don't know whether you dare doing so again.
No.
But I mean, given the success of the Houthis, basically distorting world trade they're a pretty small group when you look at it on a global scale. Is this something that we need to get used to? These distortions of shipping lanes? And
I'll let Marvin answer that actually, because we cover that in the interview that I recorded with him just earlier. So very, very interesting question. Just for the short term, I'm done trying to predict a peace in Gaza. For me, it's logical that the war is coming to an end, but both sides seem extremely eager to keep on fighting for some reason, or for various reasons. As long as Hamas and the Palestinians are under attack, the Houthis have some sort of casus belli to keep attacking international shipping. But a question, very good question, as you ask, is this something we could see elsewhere? Has some genie been let out of the bottle? We'll get on with the interview with Marvin and get his take on things, and we'll be back after the interview with some more actionable analysis of the business cycle and other stuff. So now I have the great pleasure of introducing back to the show Marvin Barth, independent macro researcher and the founder of Thematic Markets. Great to have you. Welcome to the show, Marvin.
Hey, thank you very much, Mikkel. It's glad to be back. One of my favorite programs.
Oh, really glad to hear that. So we're going to touch on a couple of issues today. We're going to talk a little bit about the Middle East, a little bit about US v. China, the whole tariff war, the trade war going on, and then perhaps paint them a more long-term picture about how geopolitics are going to be influencing markets and what's going to be the nature of geopolitics, perhaps for the coming decades. So really, really looking forward to this talk, Marvin. One of my favorite geopolitics and macro follows out there. So I would like to start in the Middle East. We've obviously seen, since the outbreak of hostilities back in October between Hamas and Israel, the spillover to the Red Sea. Obviously, the Middle East have sort of reemerged as a geopolitical risk area and to the forefront of geopolitical news. So how do you think markets have reacted to this? Has it been logical reactions, or how do you view that?
So I would say it's actually quite surprising. Although if you take a step back and look at some of my prior research into how markets deal with uncertainty, it's perhaps a little bit more understandable. But, you know, if you look at where volatility was priced, and not just like at the money volatility, but if you look at it, the wings, say butterfly pricing, you were at near historical lows on, March 28th. Going into Israel's attack on the IRGC compound in Damascus. And then, vol did go up, and the volatility smile got a little bit more convex. That is a bigger smile, which is suggesting that markets were pricing in a bit more room, but it was still, near historic lows. And, we're almost right back down to them now, right? And at first you say, well, gosh, that doesn't actually seem like markets are actually pricing this correctly. And by the way, I don't think that they are. There are fantastic opportunities out there to hedge your portfolio against geopolitical risks as a result. But it actually makes a lot of sense with how people handle uncertainty. So uncertainty, I'm going to be very precise here in mathematical terms, is non-quantifiable risk. So you go to the blackjack table, you know what the odds of getting an ace are if you're showing a 10, right? And whether you should hit again or not. You think about like the probability of a hurricane or something hitting Florida, okay? We have a rough subjective view of the probabilities of that. Uncertainty is, I have no idea what that probability is. In fact, I might not even know what's in the probability set. So like my favorite example is, of course, COVID. Like, if I had talked to you at the end of 2019 and said, next year, I think there's a good chance that 7 billion people are going to be under lockdown, you would have said, that's not even on the menu, Marvin. Right? Exactly. So when you are faced with uncertainty, what people do is they basically retreat from risk. Activity goes down, which drives realized volatility down. And then, of course, vol traders say, oh, well, realized vols really cheap. So actually, I'm going to bid down implied vols.
So I'd like to get back to one thing you mentioned. It almost sounded like you don't think markets have priced in the uncertainty currently in the Middle East, or are they underestimating the situation?
So there's a few different things here, Mikkel. No, I don't think that they have. I think that's very clear. But I think it's also important to think that this is not just the Middle East. Like, I think this is a key mistake people are making in thinking about the current environment. They think, oh, well, you know, there's this war going off in Ukraine. And, oh, yeah, you know, there's this thing going on in Gaza with Israel. And, yeah, you know, maybe it has something to do with Iran. And, oh, you know what? There's this independent thing going on over in Venezuela with them threatening to invade Guyana. And there's this really other interesting thing going over in the Philippines right now with China. No, these are not disconnected events. They are connected events. Like, you know, as we're recording this today, Vladimir Putin is meeting with Xi Jinping in Beijing. This is about coordinated efforts to get the U.S. dispersed and distracted and overstretched all around the world to open up the playing table. And so if you're not looking at it that way, you are absolutely underpricing the risks. But even if you just think about the Middle East, like, let's just say we talk about just the potential for a direct Iran-Israel war breaking out. You know, the most important thing that happened last month was not the direct missile exchange between the two countries. It was, and I know you pay attention a lot of attention to shipping, Mikkel. Mm. It was the seizure of the Israeli ship in the Straits of Hormuz. Yeah. That was just a direct signal. Hey, guys, what's going on in the Red Sea? We can do that to the Persian Gulf any day we want.
Very interesting. Very, very good point. That potentially has a lot more ramification for global markets, basically. So how do you view if everything is connected, as you say, which I very much agree upon? How do you view like the outlook for the Red Sea crisis for Gaza? Are we going to see stabilization? Going to see return of trading flows to the Red Sea anytime soon, or is this going to be a permanent area of conflict, you think?
Well, nothing is permanent, Mikkel, but
that's true.
In terms of market views, yeah, I mean, we should expect this. I think actually this is, I think, a very underappreciated, another very underappreciated aspect of what's going on is that we have seen in the last 2 years, two of the world's most sophisticated navies held at bay by countries without navies, yeah. Right? So, you know, Russia has had to pull all its ships out of Sevastopol and offshore in Ukraine because they're getting taken out by Ukrainian drones. Meanwhile, in the Red Sea, the U.S. seems the most powerful navy in the world seems to be able to do nothing to stop the Houthis from at will attacking ships that are passing by. Its allies, by the way, not much publicized, and you know, sorry to mention this to the Danes, but you know, the Danes and the French have had to pull back their navies because they ran out of missiles, right?
Yeah, the systems weren't working basically on the Danish ship that got attacked. Yeah,
so I don't think it's going away to answer your question, no. But I think there's a broader point here, which is we have had. Everyone loves to talk about globalization and you know, about the fall in tariffs and things like that, but they almost forget about it, almost like people forget that you're breathing oxygen. That this only happened because the U.S. Navy was guaranteeing freedom of the seas. We have seen the Black Sea largely shut down to a lot of trade, and perhaps increasingly so going forward. We're seeing it happen in the Red Sea. It's not a complete shutdown, but, you know, it's significantly impaired. I think you should start thinking about the fact that we are going to be seeing this in a lot more places because the ability of smaller states and even NGOs to you know, effectively commit offense on the high seas and keep the world's most powerful navies at bay has gone up dramatically.
That's incredibly interesting, and that's perhaps one of the reasons why the US were so quick to congratulate the new, I believe it was new prime minister in Singapore. That is a potential hotspot as well, especially for these developments. Absolutely, incredibly interesting. Let's pivot a bit to the US, to the underlying US-China conflict here, which is sometimes, of course, being compared to the Cold War scenario. The one big difference, of course, to the US-China relationship compared to US-Soviet relations is that we're trading a lot with China. We had almost no trade going on with the Soviet Union back then. But that trade is slowly decoupling, or what? We're seeing a trade war. We're seeing the U.S. now. A little bit surprising to me that Biden has announced these new tariffs on steel, on EVs without any Chinese sort of provocation. As Stan Research, we were expecting a Chinese devaluation. This could have been a response to a Chinese devaluation. So how do you see this? Is this sort of a trade offensive by the Biden administration? Is it a response to what's going on in the Middle East? How do you view this?
So I don't think it's about trade. Let me take one step back and mention, there has been this long-held view over the last several decades that countries that trade together don't go to war with each other. Go back and read your Victorian literature and economic analysis and geopolitical analysis going into 1914. People said the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Who was the UK's biggest trading partner at the time? Germany. Yeah. Like, by a wide margin. It wasn't even close, right? So, first of all, let's just throw out that canard. Totally wrong.
Hitler got all of his natural meat and all his materials from the Soviet Union just before invading them as well, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, one of the key reasons why we didn't trade so much with the Soviet Union is because, the U.S. is, the U.S. and the former Soviet Union, Russia, are the two most resource-endowed places on Earth. They didn't need to trade resources with each other, and that was really the only thing that Russia offered at the time. So what's different is, and I think this is a really, really important point that gets to the Biden tariffs and why they're doing it, is that most people in markets, and not just markets, I think in politics, in policy making in general, have looked at China as an economic phenomenon and looked at their policies, even their economic policies, as an economic phenomenon or as economic policies. That's a mistake. China has for at least 25 years been practicing what they told us they were: unrestricted warfare. Right? Warfare by other means rather than just kinetic. Right? And so they have been building out their capacity to challenge the post-war liberal order and U.S. leadership of it and reassert themselves as the, middle kingdom within their own order. That has been the goal. And to do that, you need a massive industrial base, which, by the way, does two different things, especially if you undermine everyone else's industrial base at the same time, is you make them dependent on you so they can't go to war with you. And two, of course, you have all the means of production, which, as we're seeing in Russia and Ukraine right now, is crucially important to waging a major war, right? And so this has been the strategy all along. And so, unfortunately, the U.S. was very late to see this. And I would see the Biden administration, if you think about the tariffs they put on, it's economically insignificant. I think, what were the numbers? Somebody said it's like $18 billion worth of goods. It's nothing. But it's about stopping them from removing yet another industry that might be important in defense terms from the U.S. That's what it's about. It's a prophylactic measure, not a trade or economic measure.
Yeah, so basically the idea here is that if we allow Chinese EVs to enter our markets, they will eventually swamp our markets because they can be produced much more cheaply out there. And then eventually we won't have the capacity to build an EV without at least some parts from China. That's more or less what's happening on laptops, on computers, on smartphones. I mean, if we cut all the ties to China, and by we, I mean either Europe or the West, could we even produce a laptop? I mean, if it's obviously it would be possible, but not at any not in the extent that we need it. So that's a very interesting point. And obviously, EVs are perhaps the first step in what's also going to be an electrification of military vehicles, planes, cars, whatever. So very, very interesting. So how do you view this? I saw on your blog you've been using the term new state capitalism. That's a very old concept, and it's one we had almost thrown in the bin during the happy 90s of globalization. So is what China is doing, is it sort of state capitalism? Do you think the EV producers are state-backed, or how do you view this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's no question. By the way, just one quick note on what you just said. It's not just about computers, right? Like, what is a car today?
Yeah.
Except a giant computer with wheels. You know, you go down the list, most of the things that we take for granted, we cannot produce anymore by ourselves because we require all sorts of inputs in the production function that come from China. But China is increasingly self-sufficient in almost all of this stuff. And that was, by the way, their goal. That's the whole China 2025 program. Now, look, the state capitalism model, I think this is another really important point. And it comes to a lot of what you hear on, you know, the press, in social media, otherwise in reaction to the Biden tariffs, which is that, well, you know, we shouldn't resort to these sort of things. We should just get more competitive. And you know, if we don't, all tariffs are going to do is make our industries soft. Well, that's not really the way it works, right? I mean, first of all, China is the second or largest economy in the world, depending how you look at it. They are, without question, and by a significant margin now, the largest manufacturer in the world. And how did they get there in a period of 20 to 25 years? The state capitalism model is one where you repress household consumption and force savings into a state-controlled banking system or financial sector, which is exactly what China has. Now, once it's there, you can direct that lending at a lower cost of capital than your competitors can to whatever industry you think is strategic. And that's exactly what China has done. So everybody loves to talk about China's cheap labor. It has nothing to do with China's cheap labor. Cheap labor was never part of the equation. It was cheap capital that was part of the equation. When you direct capital at an underprice, like, you know, if a Chinese state-owned enterprise can borrow at 1% and you have to borrow at 5%, guess what? You're not going to compete with them no matter how cheap your labor is and no matter how high your tariffs are. That's what's going on here. And that's been going on for a long time. And that's why China has had this outrageous share of GDP, you know, between 45 and 55% of GDP going to investment for 25 years straight. You look at the worst periods of state capitalism under Korea and Japan that led to their bubbles, you're talking 30, 35%. China is a much bigger economy and has been doing it at 45 to 55%. It's not even close.
Very, very fascinating numbers. And I mean, still, it seems to me that the Chinese are, even though they are trying to build sort of a global South alliance, they are trying to strengthen their position within LATAM, within Africa, South Asia as well. It still appears to me that they need us as a market for all their goods. But is that just a matter of time, or how do you view that?
Yeah, so I think I think you're pointing to one of their Achilles heels potentially. But also going back to exactly what I said before, looking at it as an economic incentive or an economic policy rather than a statecraft or national security policy. So most of the things that they're building out capacity in, and you know, everybody's focused on electric vehicles, but that's because there's all sorts of components that go into electric vehicles that are crucial to national defense right now, the same technologies. But you know, their biggest focus has been building out their capacity for microchips, for you know, advanced materials, for all the things that are high-tech goods that they need in the military space, right? And that has been the focus. And I think when people look at this and say, well, but they built all this capacity, they need to use it. This is a point that I keep emphasizing regarding their excess capacity. It's a feature, not a bug. Part of it is, one, undermining everybody else's capacity, making them dependent on it, as we discussed before. But the second thing is, like, you'll see these articles now about how, well, actually, the reason why Chinese electric vehicles are gaining market share is they're so much better than everybody else's. Well, you know, if I have an apple orchard and it's 10 times the size of yours, and I only ship to the market 1/10 of my production, do you think my apples are going to be a lot better than yours? I mean, this is the point. If you are them, going from, you know, an impoverished country that was way behind technologically to a richer country that competes with the US on any technical front, you actually want excess capacity because you're going to get there and learn to do things better by doing as much of it as possible. And if the cost of that is, oh, we have a bunch of wasted cities, their real estate, a bunch of wasted factories, they don't care. That was never the point to begin with, right? So I think that's where people get it wrong. But it is an Achilles heel in the sense that you mentioned how they're trying to reach out to the global south. I think they're going to have a real problem in a few years as the G7, which are the major consuming nations in the world, shut off their gates to Chinese goods, as is happening. And all of that stuff is directed at places like Brazil. Do you think Brazil is going to want to see it, every single industry it has, eviscerated, or that it has anywhere near the capacity to absorb Chinese production? Not possible. So they're going to create a lot of tensions for themselves going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's that should at least be a risk in the strategic mind of the Chinese leaders, especially when they look at Taiwan, when they look at other things. I mean, right now that inflow of capital from the West, when we buy all their stuff, seems to still be really, really important and very, very hard to replace. Even though Africa is growing in population, the sheer capital of Europe and to a bit lesser extent the US is still very hard to replace. So if let's just play the game. If you look at this from the American perspective, I mean, right now it seems that starting with the Trump administration, but very much continued with the Biden administration, the stance has been to force a decoupling, or at least to begin a decoupling of the economies, to build a stronger strategic supply network and production networks in the US. But I mean, does this have to be a competitive situation against China, or is there a situation where we can make sort of a grand bargain with China and coexist with them?
It's hard to see how that happens. I mean, the systems are so incompatible, right? I mean, so one of the things I think it has been sort of a subcontext for our discussion so far, and that you see in a lot of these suggestions that somehow, you know, China's trade policy is normal and we just need to adjust to it. It's not. It's a very different system. They think the state has the answers and should dictate what they're going to produce. And just because they've created a supposed capitalist system with profits and whatever, if it's all in the end being directed by the Communist Party. Oh, you get loans, you don't. It's not capitalist, not state directed. That's why it's called state capitalism. Our system is all about, you know, we can complain that we're not as pure as capitalist as we claim. True, no question. But it is much more market-based and using market price signals to do this. You can't have the two biggest economies in the world operating on two different systems like that. That's necessarily going to create conflict. But then there's the broader issue, which is that the underlying issue that is most important in Beijing is the survival of the Communist Party. It's survival and domination. And I think this is one of these things where markets massively underestimate the potential for a war over Taiwan or some sort of Taiwan crisis, because they cannot have an independent China with a different governance system operating under our rules and framework. And by the way, getting rich and doing well without it being a fundamental existential threat to the Communist Party's rule in China. That's what it's all about. And so as long as that's the case, you know, this was the same reason why there was this conflict with the Soviet Union. Our very existence is a threat to the idea that underlies their rule.
Very interesting. So just to I don't know if this is summing up or moving on to the concept you call global entropy. And so if we, as an investor, if you look at geopolitics for the coming decades, is it just a matter of conflict, increased conflict levels? How do you see that?
Yeah, so look, let's divide the world into two states of the world. One is that, you know, so you mentioned this term I use, global entropy, which I think a lot of other people have referred to as sort of the breakdown of the rules-based system, whatever you want to call it. But it's basically us moving from a unipolar, U.S.-dominated post-World War II world to one that is more multipolar. And is under a different regime. And that process has been going on for 30 years, okay? I date the first parts of it back to 1990, 1991, but, you know, there have been progressive moves along there. And it was a gradual process. But we are now getting to a point where it's so advanced that it's becoming unstable. And the potential for a rapid cataclysmic change is possible. So it's kind of like, think about playing the game Jenga. You know, you can keep taking pieces out and nothing happens. And then all of a sudden you take one, just all falls, right? We're at risk of that. That's what all this, what I was talking about in terms of these expanding fronts everywhere in the world. Even if that's not designed as a, or being facilitated by Russia and China to, jointly, as I suspect it is, just that itself has the potential to create that collapse. And so let's suppose that doesn't happen. If that does happen, you'd better be buying vol the way I mentioned, because there are really cheap mechanisms for you to do that. And, you know, I just published a piece all about how you can do that very cheaply. But let's just talk about, let's suppose that it continues on its evolutionary path. Well, I think, you know, you are going to see a very clear bifurcation of the world. And it's going to be bifurcated on two things, technology and resources, right? So technology is the key to economic growth and innovation from here. And it is also the key to military power, okay? So that's crucial. Nothing's going to happen without technological development. On the other side, you need resources to actually make these things work. You need all the critical minerals that go into them. So if you look at the Anglos, there are basically two places in the world where you have cutting-edge development of technology. I know that continental Europeans are not going to like to hear this, but frankly, there's a reason why there are very few European unicorns. And why you aren't seeing tech develop there. Europe's really good at taking other people's technology and engineering it and making it great. They're not very good at creating it. That happens in the Anglosphere, right? It happens in the US, the UK, Australia, Canada, right? Now, those guys also happen to be, other than the UK, happen to be endowed with immense amount of resources. So they don't have to worry about resources or their technology. They got it all. The other place that has technology is China. They don't have as much in the way of resources. That's why they need Russia. So you, that sort of forms a duopoly there. And so that's your division along the world. And we are going to see increasing division in terms of economies along those two axes, in terms of trade, in terms of export controls around technology, around critical minerals. All those things are going to happen. That's the long run path.
Very interesting. And we're obviously seeing that with the, as I mentioned before, the rebuilding of US strategic production and supply networks. We are expecting, we'll touch more upon that in coming shows. We're hearing a lot of talks about a vastly increased EU budget for the next round. A lot of the previous, what would you call that, frugal EU countries are now moving towards massively expanding the EU budget to match the state capitalism of China, and as well some of the measures being taken in the US, and obviously to defend, to invest in common defense as well. So a lot of geopolitical trends to shape your portfolio and your market strategy. It was a great pleasure having you here, Marvin. Some really great perspectives. Some are a little bit sinister, but that's sometimes needed as well when talking about the big picture here. Great pleasure having you. Thanks as always.
It's always a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to coming back again. If you recall the last time I was on here, I said exactly my big worry for 2024 is exactly what we're talking about. So.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. We'll see. We'll see. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Take care, Mikko.
Great. Money. Welcome back after this interview with Marvin Barth. What a great interview, very interesting narratives and perspectives, in my opinion. Some of them a little bit sinister, but that's okay. Andreas, before we round off the show, I want to touch upon our portfolio, obviously, on stainresearch.com, but also perhaps the angle into that should be the current business cycle. We published what we call a business cycle watch, which basically covers where are we in the business cycle and what does that mean for certain sectors, effects, etc. It seems like you still believe there are some upside in the manufacturing sector.
Yeah, at least I consider what happened through April a fluke. Mm. We had an obvious soft patch in data through April. In lack of better explanations, I think it was very driven by the quote-unquote fear ahead of the FOMC meeting in early May. We saw how the consensus was building a very hawkish narrative. Could Powell open the door for rate hikes? And he basically took that risk off the table. And as soon as we got that message from Powell, we got a reignition of the business cycle. We got a clear re-increase in the demand for goods in our now costs. We got a clear increase in congestion again. So it all happens very quickly in this cycle. This is not a normal business cycle by any means, and it's been distorted since 2020 due to political choices, due to lockdowns, reopenings, and all that shit. And when you look at seasonal patterns in March and April, it's been one big mess. And I guess the best explanation is that when you look at March, March 2020 was probably the worst month in the history of the world from an economic perspective due to the like simultaneous lockdowns. We had reopenings during April. So the question of trying to readjust data that is seasonally adjusted to this mess is very tricky. And we've seen distortions to seasonal adjustments in March and April. So don't rule out major revisions again once we get the next releases. And again, I think there was a soft patch in actual consumption and stuff like that in April, but we see no whatsoever signs of it continuing into May. Point being that the business cycle is probably underestimated here, the strength of it, rather. So given that, the commodity cycle still looks very interesting. When you look at our beta studies versus the business cycle, most commodities still look cheap, maybe with gold as the clear exception. Oil is a good example. In all transparency, we bought oil the other week with hopes of a rebound in the business cycle in May, June. When you look at FX, I think the dollar looks a little bit too strong relative to the cycle here. And some of the very typically very sensitive cyclical FX pairs, they look too cheap. When we look at rebalancing flows from the real money community through the end of May, we're also seeing one of the strongest sell signals on the dollar in a while in our models. Go check out our quant signals if you want to track that model day in and day out. It's very thoroughly tested. And then when you look at equities, it's a bit trickier to find deep fucking value, to use that phrase, now that we've been talking about GameStop and the likes over the past week. But there is deep value in South Korea, China, and that region. That's maybe what we're seeing right now, with tailwinds blowing across the board in Southeast Asia. So I think we're at a very critical juncture. We're basically standing at a crossroads. The narrative has turned very dovish and very negative on the US cycle. I consider that wrong. And I guess there is value to be found here if you fight the tape, but the timing is obviously critical. So you need to watch our running trade alerts to get a sense of when we actually enter it.
Absolutely. I think that pretty much sums up our program for the day, Andreas. Any last points you want to get out there?
No, I just want to say that I'm happy that we had Marvin on the show again. I've known Marvin for a while, and he's one of my favorite sparring partners. But I have to admit that Marvin is also a glass half empty type. While I consider myself the opposite, which is why I like to discuss with him, because I mean, he typically takes the opposite view of me in many aspects, and that's what you need. Don't just call up someone you always agree with, right? And Marvin is a good example of someone I typically disagree with, which is why I like him a lot.
So if you really disagree with all our views here, go on to stainresearch.com and sign up for a subscription to get even more stuff that you disagree with. Can only make you more clever now. Obviously, you can check out our entire scope of content on there, as well as our data hub, our live portfolio with trade alerts, as you mentioned, Andreas. I think that's pretty much it for this week. We'll be back next week. Will you be back from Greece next week? Almost.
Yeah.
I think so.
And we're joined by Freya Beamish.
That's true.
To discuss when this goddamn Chinese devaluation shows up. So tune in for that.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot to you for joining down from sunny Greece, Andreas, and thanks a lot to everyone for watching in. Remember that this show is all about our trade ideas. Some of them may be...
Sometimes may be good, sometimes may be shit.
Thanks a lot for watching. See you next week.